I have confirmation that we have a quorum, so I'm going to call the meeting to order and ask everyone to stand for the reading of the memorial resolutions. Let me recognize Professor Roseanne Clark to present the memorial resolution for Professor Emeritus Alan Gurman.
Alan S. Gurman was Professor Emeritus in the Department of Psychiatry in the School of Medicine and Public Health. He died on September 6, 2013. During his 40-year career at the University of Wisconsin, Al Gurman advanced the field of psychology with 20 books, including the world-renowned Handbook of Family Therapy, the Clinical Handbook of Couples Therapy, 130 articles and book chapters, and as the editor of the Journal of Marriage and Family Therapy. Regarded as a brilliant theoretician, expert clinician, dedicated teacher, and devoted mentor to psychology interns, psychiatry residents, and graduate students, Al was the recipient of numerous awards, including the Psychologist of the Year Award from the American Psychological Association. Proud husband, father, and grandfather, he loved his family deeply. He is survived by his life partner and good friend, Jerry, his wonderful sons, Jesse and Ted, his daughter-in-law, Tori, and precious grandson, Benny. The University of Wisconsin and the international family psychology community deeply misses but have been enormously enriched by the gifts and the legacy of Dr. Alan S. Gurman.
And I want to recognize that Jerry Gurman and their two sons are here in the back of the room. Thank you very much for coming. Let me recognize Professor Emeritus Charles N. Fisher to present the memorial resolution for Professor Emeritus Susan B. Horowitz.
The Department of Computer Sciences honors the life and work of Professor Emeritus Susan B. Horowitz, who passed away this summer. She was a devoted educator and researcher, noted for service to her discipline on both the university and national levels. One important legacy of hers is her championing of students, including women, who might otherwise overlook opportunities in computing. To that end, she founded the Wisconsin Emerging Scholars Computer Science Program, abbreviated WESCS. She also leaves a legacy through her many publications and through her research that impacted private industry and everyday computing. If any of you have noticed you have many fewer blue screens on your Windows systems than you once did, it's because of her research. Her particular emphasis on software development environments, program slicing, data flow analysis, and pointer analysis. She'll be greatly missed.
And let me note that Professor Horowitz's husband, Professor Tom Reps, and her father-in-law are both here, and thank you both for coming. Let me again recognize Professor Emeritus Charles N. Fisher to present the memorial resolution for Professor Emeritus Eldo Koenig.
The Department of Computer Sciences wishes to remember the life and work of Professor Emeritus Eldo Koenig. He passed away this year. Coming to UW-Madison after nearly 20 years with Alice Chalmers Corporation, Professor Koenig helped organize the Computer Sciences Department in the mid-60s. During his career, he published over 50 works pertaining to computers and computing, including the book Knowledge Structures for Communications in Human-Computer Systems. He was also an active member of leading professional societies, such as the Association for Computing Machinery, the IEEE Computer Society, and the American Association for Advancement of Science. We mourn his passing.
Thank you. Let me recognize Professor Stephen Small to present the memorial resolution for Professor Emeritus Joseph P. Lawton.
Joseph Lawton, Professor Emeritus of Child and Family Studies, now known as Human Development and Family Studies, died peacefully at his Madison home on May 7, 2014, at the age of 79. He was born and educated in England, receiving his PhD from Leeds University. Professor Lawton joined the UW faculty in 1974 and served three terms as department chair, providing leadership through several critical periods in the department's evolution. He taught and influenced the development of hundreds of undergraduate early childhood education students who in turn positively guided the development of thousands of children. Professor Lawton's research focused on the educational and familial factors that promote young children's development. He is fondly remembered as a warm, conscientious, and committed scholar and colleague. He will be missed.
Thank you very much. You may be seated. Let me make a few announcements. I hope that everyone who came into the room had a chance to pick up a copy of the budget and brief that's sitting in the back of the room. If you didn't get a copy, pick one up as you leave. This is my effort to communicate with those who care, particularly those in the state legislature, where the money comes from and where the money goes at the University of Wisconsin here in Madison in simple and clear language and charts. So I encourage all of you to look at this. There's copies of this available online. We've got a lot of hard copies. We're going to be sending it out to quite a few people, including all of the newly elected senators and representatives and people in the governor's office. And I hope it's going to help on the discussion of transparency in UW-Madison budgeting. So that's comment number one. Comment number two, as you all know, we are discussing a new budget model for how we distribute money here in Bascom Hall to the deans and the schools and colleges. And it's that first step of distribution. The deans still have complete discretion over how they in turn distribute money to the different departments and other centers inside the schools. There will be a number of discussion sections that are available, and I at one point had a piece of paper with that list in my hand. I don't see Daryl here. They are available. This has been announced in Inside Wisconsin. The notes are available online as to when these sessions take place. And if people actually want the public notice, I'll make sure to get it before this leaves. But there will be some public discussion available for this proposed budget model, and I encourage you and your colleagues who are interested in this issue to be sure and attend. There's several that are scheduled this month. Thirdly, the search committee for the dean of the graduate school has been charged and launched. That will be announced in Inside Wisconsin this coming week as to who the members of that committee are. Tony Goldberg is the chair of the committee, who I suspect many of you know, and I'm looking forward to that committee operating over the next several months. Within the next week or two, we will be announcing the search committee for the vice chancellor for research and graduate education, and charging that committee. So both of these committees for these two positions, which as you all know, have been split from one into two, will be working over the next several months and hopefully converge in a set of appointments by the end of this academic year. So that's just information on what's happening there. That is the end of my announcements. Joellen, do you have anything you want to announce? Are there any questions or issues that people want to raise? Seeing no hands, let us turn to the approval of the minutes from October 6th, 2014. This is found on page 9 of 22 in your packet. Are there any additions or corrections to the minutes of this date? Seeing none, I'm going to state that the minutes are approved as written. Let me then recognize Professor Parmish Ramanathan, who's going to submit for informational purposes only the annual report of the Advisory Committee for the Office of Equity and Diversity for 2012-13 and 2013-14. Professor, excuse me. Yeah, come.
Yeah. Well, the report is on the agenda. So basically, this committee meets about once a month to discuss equity and diversity issues on campus, meets with campus leaders typically to talk about the issues. So one of the main issues that we discussed last year, for example, was the various laws that are coming down the pike regarding Women Against Violence Act, Title IX, ADA, need for documenting veterans, and so on. And there are various entities in campus, the responsibility for making sure that we are compliant is distributed across the campus right now. And one of the recommendations we are pursuing is to try and find one person who can kind of coordinate all of these things so that there is a focal point and it is dealt with in a uniform fashion. If you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer.
Are there questions? Thank you very much. And thanks to your committee for its work. If you now turn to page 14 of 22, we are moving to section, mysteriously titled section 2-332. I have no idea exactly how any of these numbers get added, to faculty legislation, which defines language describing hostile and or intimidating behavior. I remind all of you that this was first presented at the last Faculty Senate meeting. There was an open discussion, and UC Chair Professor Jo Ellen Fair is going to now, UC having taken that discussion and other input that they received, made some changes to this document, is now going to move its approval. Jo Ellen.
This faculty legislation on hostile and intimidating behavior ensures that all faculty members...
I move it first?
Yes. Oh. I was going to move it and make it. Okay.
I'll call on you first.
All right. Do that. Let me move to add section 2332 to faculty legislation defining language describing hostile and or intimidating behavior.
I need a second. Is there a second?
I'd like to make a motion. Move to amend.
We have a motion on the floor first, and I need a second on this motion before I can have any other motion. I hear a second. I am going to call on Jo Ellen to explain the background for this before I open it up for discussion.
Yeah. This faculty legislation on hostile and intimidating behavior ensures that all members of our community have the freedom to carry out their work and to be able to speak without fear of bullying by rogue colleagues who would damage their career through deliberate and pervasive intimidation. This policy comes in response to a growing number of cases of overt intimidation on our campus. It is needed because existing sanctions on harassment in the workplace are limited to protected classes, matters of race, ethnicity, gender, sexuality, or national origin, for instance. The faculty legislation we forward to you today carefully safeguards free speech and the high value we put on academic freedom. In fact, this legislation is about making sure that all of us are guaranteed, safeguarded by the university's guarantee of academic freedom. Both the informal and formal processes described in the legislation work to ensure due process for anyone who is alleged to have engaged in hostile and/or intimidating behavior. Over the past month, the legislation has been carefully revised and strengthened in a productive engagement among UC members with a number of senators and other faculty who had concerns about the impact of the earlier version of the legislation on free speech and or due process. I'm glad to report that since our last Faculty Senate meeting, we have reached a broad consensus on our language. These colleagues that the UC has worked with now agreed to the need for a policy on hostile intimidating conduct. We have worked together to improve our approach as well as strengthen the language. You will note that we have added language in the first paragraph to clarify that incidental acts are not the target of the policy. And the bullet points that follow, particularly points 3 and 4, we have made small adjustments to sharpen the focus. And finally, in the last paragraph of part 1, is stronger and clear language that protects the rights to freedom of expression and freedom of academic culture. Part 2 remains identical to the proposed legislation you saw in the first in our last Senate meeting. We all agree that it is not necessary to amend FPNP. The legislation before you accomplishes that need. Some senators may still have some reservations or objections. If there are any of these, it's good to hear them. But the UC is pleased with the legislation that is before you and urges you to approve it.
All right, this is open for discussion. I'd ask if people go to the microphones because we're recording this. Yes.
Chad Goldberg, District 71. I want to commend the University Committee for the hard work they've put into this. I would like to suggest a last-minute alteration, which I don't think should be controversial, but I'll put it out here. I move to amend item 6, the recommendation to add section 2332 to faculty legislation as follows. First, insert the following before the last sentence of the last paragraph of part 1. nor is it intended to constrain the freedom of faculty to speak out about troubling matters, criticize the administration or university policies, take part in political protests, or promote and participate in labor unions. Second, add union representative to the list of intermediaries in Part 2, Section A, first paragraph. And thirdly, insert the following before the last sentence of the first paragraph in Part 2, Section B, Item 1. The written complaint filed with the provost must also be shared with the faculty member or members against whom the disciplinary or dismissal process is initiated.
Can you read that again so everyone
sure.
can hear it?
Read it again one more time.
First,
insert the following before the last sentence of the last paragraph of Part 1. Nor is it intended to constrain the freedom of faculty to speak out about troubling matters, criticize the administration or university policies, take part in political protest, or promote and participate in labor unions. Secondly, add union representative to the list of intermediaries in Part 2, Section A, first paragraph. And thirdly, insert the following before the last sentence of the first paragraph in Part 2, Section B, Item 1. The written complaint filed with the provost must also be shared with the faculty member or members against whom the disciplinary or dismissal process is initiated.
Is there an amendment on the floor? Is there a second to that amendment? Second? So now we will have discussion on the amendment only and deal with the amendment before we return to the discussion of the larger motion. Joellen, would you like to address the amendment?
Yes, please. And I'm sorry, I promised that I would remind everyone to state their names and their district or their department when they speak. So I've done that now. Thank you. I really appreciate these amendments. I think that it is important for us to consider a whole range of issues that are before us. And certainly, the university's committee's goal in creating this legislation is to provide an outlet and a remedy for anyone who is seeking a remedy for issues when they feel themselves to be working in a hostile and or intimidating environment. In terms of the first call here for adding the final sentence in Part 1 to add the language, nor is it intended to constrain the freedom of faculty to speak about troubling matters, criticizing the administration or university policies, take part in political protest, or promote and participate in labor unions. There are two matters that I think that we need to consider here. One, that this is language about hostile and intimidating behaviors. I think in many ways this particular language, while important and valuable, and we all want to see this, and we all think it's important to be able to criticize and participate politically, takes us off target. The second point I would make with regard to this language is that we are already provided this guarantee in FPNP 8.01. We are also guaranteed this through the Supreme Court decision of Garcetti in 2006 and various kinds of carve-outs that have come from the Garcetti Supreme Court case that have come out of the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. So I don't think that this adds anything to the legislation in terms of the current target focus of the legislation, and I believe that we already have these kinds of freedoms as faculty members. In terms of adding union to the list of intermediaries, it's not an exhaustive list. It says such as, and such as means that this is not exhaustive. So we could add union, we could add spiritual leaders, we could add mom and dad, we could add, whoever you might want to have come in, but there's not necessarily a reason to include union specifically here. Your dog could also come as well if you wanted, really. In terms of the language that the written complaint filed with the provost must be shared with faculty member or members against whom the disciplinary or dismissal process is initiated, that's already covered under FPNP 9.06. It clearly states that a faculty member against whom a complaint has been lodged is guaranteed to have that written complaint given to him or her in full. You see this lovely chart here? Can't read it. You can't read it even when you print it out. But it is the flow chart of our dismissal process. You can find it in faculty document 1495, and it shows you very clearly, without having to go all the way through FP&P, that those rights are very much accorded to us already.
Is there other discussion on the amendment? Can I ask a question that the parliamentarian has raised with me, that the statement in the beginning, in the first part one section, which says that it should not constrain faculty from a whole variety of things, including participating in unions, I'm told that that's problematic because we are actually constrained by law that faculty at this point cannot participate in unions. So it would be, we as the Senate is not able to actually provide a right that is not allowable under law. So that language might be problematic according to what I've been told here.
So if I may speak to the objections, beginning with the most recent one, Chancellor, I respectfully disagree. I participate in a labor union now. I'm a member of UFAS, AFT Local 223, and my understanding of Act 10 is that it prohibits collective bargaining, not participation in unions. And there's no language about collective bargaining here.
Okay. I thought I was repeating what I was told.
I'm glad. Yeah. I'm glad that that issue is cleared up. Yeah. So, in regard to Joe Allen's objections, I respectfully disagree with Joe Allen. I think that even if some of this material is implicit in what the UC has already come up with, it's important to make it explicit. I think that minimizes the possibility that these changes could be misused or abused in the future. And I also think that while it may not be necessary to explicitly add union representative to the list of intermediaries, since some are already explicitly named, I think it's important to send the signal to faculty that this is also legitimate, in addition to the ones who are already specifically named in what the UC has proposed. Thank you.
Are there other comments on the amendment? In that case, I'm going to call for a vote on the amendment as described up here. All those in favor of amending the resolution as proposed and described signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
I think we should call for a show of hands. All those in favor of the amendment, raise your hand. And will one of you here help with the counting? Keep your hands up. You've got to count.
Okay.
It's okay, as in. And then the nose? Yeah. Raise your hands. The motion passes. All right, we now return to the resolution as amended, and I'm looking for any additional comments on the resolution. Yes.
Okay. Hi, Sheila Reeves from Life Sciences Communication. We've had two faculty that have experienced being bullied. One aggressor was male, but the other aggressor was female. So this isn't something that's gendered, and I'm sure you all understand that. I think the larger point is knowing what a culture of civility looks like and what incivility looks like, that it's not about a mark here or there or something like that. It's that consistent aggressive behavior. And if you've ever been bullied, you know what that feels like. In every department, I just want to remind everyone, there is a culture, and it's informal, it's unspoken about who has the power. So if someone has to contemplate going up against their executive committee, that's a pretty lonely place to be. And so I applaud the UC for bringing this up and standing by what I think are very wonderful articulated points. Thank you.
Yes.
I'm Lisa Martin. I'm in the Political Science Department. Last year, I chaired an ad hoc committee on civility in the academic workplace that was appointed by the UC. And we drafted the language that was before you a month ago. And I just wanted to say that we, at least I do, I have not consulted with the full committee, but I fully support the language that's before you today with the changes that have been made in the last month. The other point I wanted to make is that during the course of our work last year, we met with a large number of individuals on campus who have to deal with conflictual situations, deans, department chairs, colleagues in the ombuds office, and so on. And they made two points that I think are really important. One is that this kind of hostile and intimidating behavior is unfortunately not as rare as I think we would like to believe that it is. They estimated that it accounted for a fairly substantial proportion of those situations in which they need to intervene and take action. Secondly, they said that because there is no policy on campus, they find themselves really hamstrung in how they deal with these situations. There's no policy they can point to say this is where the behavior is out of line, this is what the procedures are, anything like that. So I think this is extremely important, and I hope that the policy will get your support.
Yes. Hi, I'm Deanne Pillars. I'm from the Department of Pediatrics, and I'm a member of the Committee on Women in the University. And I also want to applaud the taking forward this initiative and bring it into the Senate for approval. I think one of the issues that I just would like to add as a highlight is on behalf of the people who are no longer part of the university community, which was one of the issues that was of importance to the Committee on Women in the University, and that this incivility can be a reason for losing valued members of our community. So I again applaud the language and encourage that this be passed.
Thank you. Are there other comments on the motion?
Paul Milenkovic, Electrical and Computer Engineering. I'm speaking opposed to this measure because it takes a very narrow view of incivility, and of that narrow view, it gives very vague descriptions, and then there is this remedy for action which is set in motion. If we're talking about incivility, it can take many forms. It can be shunning. It can be exclusion from social circles. There are a whole number of behaviors that can mistreat somebody that's not encompassed by overt, hostile actions. I think that we're trying to legislate virtue. We're trying to legislate ethical behavior. And I don't see where this is going.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yes.
I think the legislation is very clear that this is not a civility code. And so, in fact, in the last paragraph, it explicitly says this is not a civility code. It is not any kind of speech code. It is about behavior that people bear the brunt of. And in fact, one of the examples of exclusion or isolation is a form of hostility and intimidation. It is one of the points that we actually do bring up. It is, I think, it is the point of this is to try to ensure that all faculty members, no matter rank, no matter status within a department, have the ability to be able to speak and to do their work. And so this is very much not about a code of being nice. It's not about what we can say, but it is about how we conduct ourselves with regard to other people. And so I want to make sure that people understand that we're not about legislating Minnesota nice. We're not about ensuring that people are just kind of kind and smile to each other or say hello in the hallways. We're talking about instances in which people undergo conditions that make it impossible for them to do their teaching or their research.
Yes.
District 51. I worry about this this project of this procedure.
Yeah.
I think that in academic environment there is some kind of violence involved in research and in education. It's not that easy and all without risk, and there is a kind of confrontation always. Any kind of new ideas hurt not only other ideas but other people. And I think of those great bullies that were condemned by something like that, Socrates, Giordano Bruno, Jan Patočka. There might be some kind of intimidating nature of truth itself, and it's not very. You cannot precisely distinguish the intimidating of a person and struggling against the dominant ideas, dominant ideology, dominant behavior. So I'd rather rely on the existing legal system and on the moral rules of behavior and of civility, which are not formally legislated.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Yes.
Grant Petty, University Committee. I'd just like to address the comment that was just made. I think that the reason why we spent as much time as we did on this and why a committee worked very hard on the language is precisely because our current legal frameworks do not actually address the issue that we're trying to solve. We've seen numerous cases over the past couple of years that I've been on UC where we have been able to say that if we had only had the ability to intervene in situations where things were getting out of hand earlier, we could have avoided some serious problems. But as to the specific concern that was just raised about normal scientific or scholarly discourse, I think the first bullet point in the language makes it fairly clear that we're talking about abusive expression directed at another person in the workplace, such as derogatory remarks or epithets that are outside the range of commonly accepted expressions of disagreement, disapproval, or critique in an academic culture and professional setting that respects free expression. So I think that that draws a clear line between the kind of thing that we just heard about and what this seeks to achieve.
Yep. Judith
Burstyn, District 48. So I was one of the people who was involved in discussions with the university committee, perhaps behind the scenes. Oops, now it's going too far down. With respect to this particular piece of legislation. And I think that I just want to stress that the group of people who were talking to the university committee were very concerned, firstly, about the fact that civility codes exist and have been used against faculty at many institutions, and we wanted to make certain that that was not what this was, and that it was very clear that this was not an opportunity for anyone to be dismissed for their academic opinions. I think the paragraph at the bottom of the first page of this legislation, which I'll just read a piece of it, these standards are to be construed within the context of the university's historical and enduring commitment to academic freedom, freedom of expression, and the conception of the university as a place that must encourage and foster the free exchange of ideas, beliefs, opinions, and opinions, however unpopular. In no case shall a sanction be imposed in response to a complaint solely about the contents of a faculty member's beliefs, views, or opinions taken in the abstract. The policy is not intended to constitute a general civility code addressing ordinary stresses of the workplace, such as occasionally insensitive language or behavior. And this language was put in here After discussion with the university committee, very deliberately to be cautious and to understand that these kinds of pieces of legislation have been used inappropriately against faculty. And yet the group of people agreed and understood that there were some issues on campus that were incompletely addressed currently with our current legislation, and felt that this was as good as it could be in terms of what we felt with protecting the freedoms of all of us to exercise our academic mission, our academic integrity, but also to allow the university to deal with legitimate cases of harassment that did not fall under existing federal statute.
I do see someone in the aisle. Yes.
Doug Reindl, District 42. I think the faculty in my district were generally supportive of this, but I think there was concerns with some of the language that was in here, and specifically in part one, the bullet items as follows: conspicuous exclusion or isolation having the effect of harming another person's reputation. I'm not sure how you prove that. That's, I think, a bit of a landmine. The other one above that, unwarranted physical contact or intimidating gestures. Can somebody give some examples of intimidating gestures? I'm not sure what they look like. So I think we were concerned with some of these being a bit of hidden landmines.
Does someone who is on the committee want to address some of the examples that you...
As far as intimidating gestures, we heard a number of cases, for example, of people who were worried about going to their car because there was someone who sat behind the door and confronted them physically as they were going to their car. So it's really that kind of very extreme behavior that this is targeted. And it's targeted at behavior that is targeted at individuals, right? Intimidating them, preventing them from carrying out their responsibilities to the university. So I think it's extremely important that it's there. I just wanted to reiterate what everyone else has said, that this is not a code of conduct. The committee explicitly decided that we did not want to go that direction.
I'll give you another example, a little bit more extreme. Faculty member was upset about the progress of a jointly written paper and got up standing quite near where one of the other faculty members who was working on this article and put his fist through the wall.
Do I introduce myself? Or?
Yes, please.
Patricia Keeley in Cell and Regenerative Biology.
Are you from a district? Or
I'm not. I'm a visitor. There are examples that are not so obvious, but that are nonetheless intimidating. For example, a colleague who has an office set up with a couch that's lower so that he sits above the graduate students and the faculty coming in to visit. A colleague giving another colleague a rose as part of a gesture that is just a little off. Hugs given in the hallway that are intended to be friendly but are not friendly. It can be very subtle. It doesn't have to be someone punching. It doesn't have to be someone stalking. But these things end up creating an environment that is sometimes hostile to some faculty. So.
Do you want to?
I can give another example. Some of these are quite extreme, and some of these are subtle. So the conspicuous exclusion or isolation, this is one that we talked a lot about, both within the committee, with ad hoc committee, with various senators as well and others who were interested in this, and we decided to leave this in, even though it's kind of a tricky one. But the idea here, in part, and it was guided by a sense of that not just social isolation, oh, I wasn't invited to the end of the semester party or something, but more isolation in terms of faculty members just not dealing with another colleague because that colleague is doing a particular kind of research, and that doesn't happen to be the mainstream research in a department. That's one of the many kinds of examples that we had. Or a faculty member who was in a research group, and then all of a sudden the research group began meeting at other times and other days. Without any kind of explanation. Those are the kinds of isolation or exclusion that a lot of faculty members are finding themselves in.
I, th- think the slippery slope is how do you prove harm? That's, I think, the challenge when it says the isolation and proving harm to their reputation. How do you prove that? And just having returned from Argentina, everybody was hugging everyone else, guys and girls, but yeah.
First of all, there's the reasonable person part of this, where in terms of explaining, one explains or one makes a case, and that's what happens all the time when one is seeking redress to a complaint that is made. You have to make the case, and you have to be able to demonstrate in both directions that reputation was harmed and reputation or reputation was not damaged. And so it's incumbent upon complaints that are made to be able to make these kinds of demonstrations, as well as there may be other cases in which there are people who can corroborate that faculty member X happened to be part of a certain kind of group and they were doing certain kinds of work and then all of a sudden was excluded from that for various kinds of reasons that he or she, others may know about. So it really is about the ability to make a case that a reasonable person could agree with.
Now I will say I see no one else coming to the microphone. I assume people are ready to vote.
No, we got one more.
You got one more. All right.
Paul Molenkovic, Electrical and Computer Engineering. On these incidents where someone was blocked from entering their car or somebody threateningly put their hand through a wall, those fall under the criminal justice system, and we had the chief of... Do you care to speak? There is a law that you don't have to batter somebody, that assault it constitutes physical actions constituting the threat. And if there is disagreement with my interpretation of the criminal law, the microphone is still open. And what I'm saying is that we're creating a parallel criminal justice system where the chief of police some years ago but had addressed this body and asked that incidents of this very nature be brought to the attention of the university police.
I cannot help to reiterate my distinction between the criminal law, as it was said right now, and the criminal procedure, when the cases can be proved, and there is they are the rules of evidence. On the one hand, the moral and civil code associated with particular culture where the meaning of a hugging can be immediately interpreted, right? We are somehow in a gray zone between the rigor of criminal justice and flexibility of moral and cultural rules of behavior. I mean, we are considering here the height of chairs and the giving flowers on the one hand, and on the other hand, hitting and destroying the wall. I mean, how is this comparable? How you want to legislate both? One is a violent criminal behavior, giving a rose. Well, come on. Thanks.
Do you have to speak? Go ahead.
Okay, Sheila Reeves, Life Sciences Communication. I am currently witnessing, in many ways, what for me has been talking with faculty of color, and they talk about microaggressions. And yes, a microaggression can be one here, maybe something there. But what I think that this proposal is about continuing microaggressions. You're having to prove a lot. on that. And right now I am witnessing, again, faculty of color. This is a young man of color. He's an assistant professor. And there is a very highly decorated professor, full professor, who's systematically calling up his colleagues, his peers out in his particular field, and telling what a lousy scholar he is. Okay, is that slander? I don't know, but it's a really big microaggression. And it's not just one phone call. It's not about academic freedom. It is about bullying. Thank you.
So I feel the need to clarify. I have friends and colleagues that I give hugs to, okay? The point is unwelcome from people who you don't want to give you a hug. And also the point is gestures that are inappropriate. And I think we are all intelligent, thoughtful people, and we know the difference. And yes, sometimes it might be a little bit of a gray line, but there needs to be some sort of statement by which somebody where this is ongoing, who has said to their colleague, look, this makes me uncomfortable, can then come back and say, this is in violation of what we have decided as a faculty. And so I do wish to clarify, I realize, you know, from some people, I would love to get flowers, from other people, not. I realize that is a little bit confusing. However, I think most of us can discern the difference for that. So hopefully it's not too confusing.
Yes.
Yeah. Hi, Deanne Pillars from Department of Pediatrics and Committee on Women in the University. I just wanted to give a personal example, having been a person who's had to deal with these issues, and underscore that we're really not talking about those things that are covered by the law because they're covered by the law. These are other things. So just to give you a couple of examples, I've had someone say that they will do everything in their power to make sure that I will never be successful at this institution. That's the kind of harassment that we're really talking about. I've had other colleagues who, in committees where there was a set agenda and a call for people to make contributions on specific issues, being told, if you don't go my way, there will be recriminations for you. And then when their item was presented to the committee, having the chair sidestep the issue and delete it from the agenda because they did not want to deal with this. So we're really talking about assuring that all of us have the opportunity to be the academicians we want to be, to contribute to the great institution of the University of Wisconsin. And there are individuals out there who abuse their privilege as faculty. And it's for the rest of the individuals that we need to have something that we can go to when we go through the process to help us clarify that we have rights to be academicians too. So I just wanted to add that personal perspective.
Noah Weith Feinstein, District 18. I would like to express my gratitude for the deep consideration which has gone into this in the drafting of the legislation, the amendment of it, and to those who've been brave enough to share their stories and their perspectives on this complex and difficult issue. Respectfully, I would like to call the question.
I need a second for the call of the question. Is there a second? And we will then vote on whether we are calling the question or not, not on the proposal itself, but whether or not everyone is ready to vote. So if you are ready to vote now, vote yes. If you'd like to continue the discussion, vote no. We need a two-thirds vote to call the question. All those in favor of calling the question indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
And all those opposed?
No.
I'm going to take that as a two-thirds vote. If we are all at that point ready to vote on an amended motion that is in front of you. The amendment was up here. You've all heard it and voted in favor of that. All those in favor of the amended motion to add section 2332 to faculty legislation indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed indicate by saying nay.
Nay.
I'm going to say that passes. Thank you all very much for a very thoughtful discussion. Agenda item number 7, Professor Timothy Yu. You are, is going to move to amend a motion previously adopted. And I will let you. Why don't you come forward and explain what you're doing?
Thank you. I am moving to rescind an amendment that was previously adopted by the Faculty Senate on May 5th, 2014. This was an amendment to faculty document 2501, Forward Together, UW-Madison's. I'm sorry. Should I not read the text?
You have moved to amend this. Do we have a second?
Second.
Got a second. All right. In that case, why don't you proceed?
Thank you. Yes, so the motion I am making is to rescind the amendment that was previously made to forward together the UW-Madison's Framework for Diversity and Inclusive Excellence. This amendment inserted in Section 2, Part C, Item 3, the following language. Because the concept of diversity and the means of its implementation are complex and sometimes controversial, the university remains dedicated to encouraging wide open and robust debate and discussion regarding the concept, its implementation, and the pros and cons of the concept and its implementation. I am bringing this motion forward because I believe that the inserted language may unintentionally serve to undermine the main aims of the diversity framework. I am particularly concerned by the amendment's characterization of the concept of diversity as controversial, and by its suggestion that the pros and cons of the concept of diversity itself should be debated. These statements contradict the framework's central goal of making a strong, positive case for diversity and its central role in maintaining the university's excellence. And simply to clarify, a yes vote for my motion would remove this language from the document. The diversity framework, which the Senate approved with overwhelming support in May, is unambiguous in its argument for the importance of diversity, offering educational, leadership, and social justice rationales. As the framework clearly states at the end of Section 3, and I quote, "Meeting the challenges of the 21st century and seizing the opportunities available to our campus in the creative and innovative ways outlined in these rationales requires the university to draw upon and expand the diversity of its students and workforce in the pursuit of excellence. It is hard to see how we can reconcile such strong positive arguments for diversity with the amendment's characterization of diversity as a controversial concept with pros and cons. The Ad Hoc Diversity Planning Committee, which authored the framework, voted in its final meeting to reject the Faculty Senate's amendment and to express concern over the language of the amendment. The Senate's amendment was also rejected by the Academic Staff Assembly in its vote to approve the remainder of the document. In approving the amendment in May, the Senate may well have been expressing its support for the amendment's encouragement of wide open and robust debate. There is nothing in the diversity framework that precludes debate on any issue. The implementation process, which is now underway, will of course produce further discussion and debate. However, the language of pros and cons and of labeling diversity itself controversial may well be interpreted by key constituencies not as an embrace of debate, but as a questioning or weakening of our commitment to diversity. While I do not believe this was the Senate's intent in improving this amendment, the ambiguous language of the amendment makes it possible to interpret the Senate's position as one that regards diversity as a controversial goal rather than as a necessary one. The language of this amendment, I would argue, places the faculty at odds with the Ad Hoc Diversity Planning Committee and with other governance groups. It risks undermining the very hard work the Ad Hoc Diversity Planning Committee has undertaken over the past 2 years, as well as the ongoing work of implementation. At a moment when signaling the university's commitment to diversity is more important than ever, this amendment, I would argue, sends precisely the wrong message. I urge the Faculty Senate to support my motion to rescind this amendment and to remove this language from the document. Thank you.
Let me just be clear so everyone understands. If you look at page 1 of 22, which is your agenda, you have there under item 7 the language that Professor Yu is proposing to remove. This is the original document without that language. So this is the way the document would read if you remove the language that is here and was amended for this. It would then make the document from the Senate identical to the classified staff and the academic staff documents. They both rejected this amendment. The faculty accepted it, and Professor Yu gave his reasons for why he would like to delete this. So is everyone clear what we're doing? This isn't the diversity framework. It's a 70-page some document. We're just showing you the part that was amended. The additions are here, which are being proposed to be removed. This is the way the language would read without them. Okay? That's what's happening. Discussion, comments on the proposal. Yeah.
Christy Clark Pujara, District 78. Like Professor Yu, I found this language with the amendment concerning. Diversity is a net good. How we implement a diversity plan is debatable and should be debated, but considering diversity debatable is a problem. Diversity is a net good.
Ellen Samuels, District 116. I would also like to speak in support of the motion. I strongly feel this language should be removed, and I'd like to cast us back to that meeting in which we passed this language, in which you may recall there was no discussion and it passed very quickly. And I can say for myself, it was a long meeting, and we were all ready to pass the diversity framework, and I didn't get up and protest the language because I thought there was no way it would pass because it was so clearly contrary to the goals of the diversity framework, which we had already discussed. And so I would hazard a guess that some of my wise colleagues here may have been in the same position as me of not being quick enough to engage with this language. And I want to thank Professor Yu for giving us the opportunity to re-engage. Finally, I would like to ask if anyone still supports this language, if you could give us an example of a con of diversity. Thanks.
Professor Downs.
Donald Downs, District 68. I was the author of this amendment. So here I am to talk about it. I wasn't sure I'd make it to the meeting in time, so I'm somewhat unprepared. Let me first say that it was my reaction. I did this because of my reaction to the overall report, which was so heavy on notions of social justice, it, in my view, seemed to presume that there was a consensus as to what social justice means. And that really concerned me. I think social justice is an inherently controversial subject. Is it John Rawls? Is it Robert Nozick? I mean, take your pick. It should be something that's always questioned. My second perspective came about because of history. 1998, Ward Connolly from California came to give a talk here. His talk was seriously disrupted by pro-diversity forces who believed there was only one way to think about diversity. It was a national embarrassment. The university did nothing about it. Other such examples occurred. The Badger Herald's office was taken over after that talk because of an editorial they wrote by students that refused to let them leave until they apologized. Nothing was done about that. A few years ago, Lee Hansen brought in a speaker about affirmative action, and his talk down at the hotel downtown was seriously disrupted by students who were opposed to his point of view. And as many of us suspect, there were certain administration people that were encouraging that particular action. So I look at the history, it seems as though there's often a closed mind about what diversity means. And I think that in principle, it's an inherently controversial subject, which should be subject to widespread debate. I myself am very much in favor of diversity. I've never spoken against it. This is an intellectual diversity, intellectual freedom kind of amendment devoted to that particular purpose. So I would encourage leaving it. If you want to take out a couple of words, I had a meeting with the university committee last summer, and they were going to change three or four words. And I actually consented to that, as long as the protection of intellectual diversity was added to that clause. Now I see the whole amendment is going to go. So I think, one can be pro-diversity, however one defines that, and still say we need some sort of amendment in this document, which in my view is very much a consensus kind of document, just in the name of protecting the idea of intellectual diversity on campus and the fact that some people disagree with how people construe diversity. It's that simple.
Noah Weith Feinstein, District 18. Don't make me break out the YouTube videos on the intersectionality of privilege, y'all. I strongly support Professor Yu's move to rescind this amendment. I think that his first point, that the amendment gains us nothing, is very important. Having that amendment would make no difference in regards to the presence or absence of protest on either side regarding diversity on campus. There is nothing in the framework that attempts to prevent or close down debate regarding diversity on campus, and I think that that's critical. My second point is regarding the audiences that are watching what we as a state institution do with regard to equity and diversity and the statements that we make with regard to equity and diversity. Many of you may know, and in the grand litany of problems that I could cite, that Wisconsin has the second largest black-white academic achievement gap in the country. Our institution, as well as other state institutions, has been repeatedly castigated for its failures to retain talented students who are underrepresented in our student body. What message does it send to them and to our other audiences that in our one framework document on equity and diversity, we claim that the idea of diversity is controversial and has pros and cons?
Krista Olson, District 55. I also support Professor Yu's call. And I want to say two things. One is that I believe, I can't remember exactly, but I believe the framework itself talks about ideological diversity as a source of value. So there's nothing in the diversity framework that suggests a particular position on how you carry out diversity. But the more important piece is we're talking about a piece of language that's added to Section 2, Part C, Item 3. Item 3 is the one that says, as we can see up here, that makes a commitment to access for underrepresented or excluded groups. This is a very strange, very problematic place to put language about diversity being controversial. This suggests that we think it is possible that the university would be better off if those underrepresented and excluded groups weren't here, if the university were still primarily white, primarily male. This place is the wrong place. If we want to talk about diversity having historical controversies, this is very much the wrong place to have that.
Are there other comments? Seeing no one moving towards the microphone, I'm going to call on a vote for Professor Yu's motion. All those in favor of removing the language that was added to Section 3 up here will indicate that by saying aye. Those who want to keep the current language, which includes what is in front of you on your agenda, will indicate by saying no. All right? Everyone clear what they're voting on? All those in favor of the amendment to remove the language, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed indicate by saying nay. The ayes have it. All right? That brings us to item number 8 on our agenda. We have a request from ASM for a few students to speak, and in order for that to happen, I need to request unanimous consent for a non-faculty speaker. I'm going to assume I have that unless hearing otherwise from anyone. All right, in that case, I'm going to call on Professor Jo Ellen Fair to... That's what I don't have to do because you've just approved. In that case, I'm going to recognize Kayla Bourne and Kate Wydell, who's going to speak about the textbook cost issue. Please.
Hello, everyone. So my name is Kayla Bourne, and this is Kate Wydell. And we're here today, as she said, as part of the Associated Students of Madison, the student government on campus, with the University Affairs Committee to speak about textbook affordability. Now, I know you've heard a lot about textbook affordability, probably, and all of the plentiful ways that you can decrease textbook costs. We're just here today to focus on one thing specifically, and that is early textbook adoptions. So the time that teachers are listing what books are going to be required for their course, and not only the books, but all materials, we're looking at making sure that not voting today on any requirement, just making sure that it's a priority amongst faculty members, amongst departments, to make sure that books are being adopted at least 2 to 3 weeks before the semester. And that way, bookstores, students, libraries can all find their books sooner at the lowest prices when the demand is low, supply is high. I'm sure you know how supply and demand works. When the books are the cheapest prices, allow more time for book swaps, and also allow more time for the longer shipping dates.
So we just want to clarify that when we're talking about textbooks, we're referring everything listed in the course guides for students. So this can include bound or online textbooks, homework codes, iClickers, lab equipment, and much more. So here we have two testimonies from students. The first says, I didn't know the books until 1 week before classes and had to buy them new because the girl who I tried buying them from sold them already. So book swaps are really beneficial by eliminating the middleman. If students don't know what books they need, then they aren't able to buy from other students. So then our second testimony says, one of my professors didn't post my textbooks until 2 days before class. I couldn't wait for the shipping, so I had to buy the book from the bookstore for more than I could have online. So by knowing what books we need earlier, we can buy online and wait for the shipping, and then we get the lowest price.
All right, now we're saying how early is early when we say early textbook adoptions. As you can see here, this is fall 2014, so right now, the most beneficial date to get adoptions out by is actually a week from today, that's November 10th. And this is when course enrollment opens up for the oldest students. When they're looking for their classes and trying to figure out what books they're going to need, and then they can start looking at this time for their materials. If you don't get them in by then, the next beneficial date would be the December 1st, and that's when bookstores are starting to figure out what books are going to be used the next semester, so they know how much they want to give back students for their books if they have, like, introductory course materials that they won't need those books anymore. So that December 1st, that's when bookstores are figuring out how much money they're giving back to students. And this is also when students are starting to talk about, all right, I don't need this book, I'll swap with you, take out that middleman as we talked about. And then 3 weeks before the semester, this is what we're really looking for, at least by 3 weeks beforehand. This is when students are really trying to get online, find their books, find them at the lowest prices, the competitive prices. And then January 21st, that's the first day of instruction for the spring 2015 semester. So that's when students get to their class, they get their syllabi, the absolute latest that they're finding out their books. If they get them then, they can't buy them online, wait for the shipping, they need those books right away. So they will end up probably going to buy them new at the highest price. And then here we have the days also for the spring semester. It's a little bit harder between spring and fall, as you can see, because there's summer in the middle of it. But this is really important because a lot of readoptions between spring and fall, if we do know that a book's going to be readopted by that spring, it's going to save students a ton of money when they're getting their books back to the bookstore. Otherwise, the bookstore is going to assume that they won't be used again.
So just as an example, we have some information from the bookstore that was on the buyback period last winter. And just to clarify, the dollar amounts on the screen is the money that the bookstore is paying back to the students for their books. So retail prices for books are books that they have received adoptions for. They are for sure going to use those next semester. And they average to pay students about $34. Speculative books are books that they don't yet have adoptions for, but they think that they're going to be used the next semester. And these average about $13 for students. So if we can get more adoptions in, we can bring more books from speculative to retail, which averages students getting more or $21 back. So last year there was 27,804 books bought back. So this really has the potential to affect a lot of students. So if you put your adoptions in sooner, students can get back the money that their books are truly worth.
So just in summary here are the benefits that we talked about with early textbook adoptions. Students in bookstores can find the lowest prices. There's more time for shipping. It's not just like you go to Target to find your textbooks nowadays. It is going to take about 2 weeks to get from the smaller vendors online, which I know for sure on my books I could have saved $80 on some of them if I had the time earlier on to be able to get my books from online sources. And then more efficient buybacks, so as we talked about, students getting more back, more bang for their buck, and then more time for book swaps to happen, and then libraries also will know to put their books on reserve because as they are adopted, there's an option to report through the faculty center what books you think that it would be beneficial to have on reserve at the library to help out more students. So I'll open myself up for questions. Otherwise, you can also email me. What we're really trying to do here is just to open it up for discussion amongst departments to make this more of a priority. to make sure that all faculty members, as soon as I understand it's hard because you don't always know what professors are going to be teaching each class up until a few weeks before the semester, but as soon as the syllabi are figured out and you know what books, materials you'll be using for the class, if you can get on the faculty center and report that right away, it can make college a lot more affordable for students.
I'm going to assume that your request to the Faculty Senate is to ask the senators to communicate with their colleagues in their district about the benefits to students of listing early what the textbooks are that are required. Is that the appropriate request? Are there any questions for either of these two students?
Can an email be sent to the faculty senators that we can forward on to our colleagues? Or?
Do you want to pass an email along to Steve Smith, who's the Secretary of the Faculty, and you can send it around to all that could be forwarded.
With the dates, including the information.
Yeah, that would be helpful. Any other comments or questions? Thank you very much. Very helpful. We have one more document to deal with. If you turn to page 16 of 22, I'm going to recognize Professor Jo Ellen Fair. This document was presented at the last meeting. It's changes to faculty policies and procedures. So at this meeting, we are going to vote on it. And I do believe Professor Fair is going to move to adopt it.
I move to adopt the University Committee recommendation to standardize and clarify the language of FPNP Chapter 6.
Say something about...
Yes, now I'm not sure when I can say what in what order. So you might remember from last spring we began our house cleaning activities with Chapter 6 when we began to include classified staff into various committees, shared governance committees in Chapter 6. This particular housekeeping detail helps us clarify punctuation. It does important things like changing past tense to present tense. It standardizes the form of the document to make it, we hope, more readable.
Are there any questions or comments on the motion? It actually does not require a second since it comes from the UC. If there are none, if everyone is ready to vote, all those in favor of adopting the amended University Committee recommendation to clarify the language in Chapter 6, indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? The motion carries. That is the end of the agenda on my list, and having no other business, I am going to adjourn the meeting. Thank you all for your help.